Interested in the forces shaping our world? The Council on Foreign Relations has you covered. For those who like to look ahead, dive into The World Next Week, hosted by Bob McMahon and Carla Ann Robbins.
We were not forecasting anything about Russian domestic upheaval, and yet that has been the story of the week.
These were scorpions going after each other in a bottle.
And for those who want to go beyond the headlines, join Jim Lindsay as he opens up the president's inbox.
What should U.S. policy do?
The approach towards China, it's enough to make me question bipartisanship.
And finally, join me, Gabrielle Sierra, on Why It Matters, as my guests and I bring some of the world's most compelling stories home to you.
Do you feel good about where we're heading with AI?
Maybe we need to invent a new word here, which kind of is a combination of frightened and excited.
I'm
excited.
So what are you waiting for?
For the world next week, the president's inbox.
And Why It Matters. We'll see you soon.
The families of those taken hostage by Hamas are facing an impossible wait for information.
These days are the hardest for us. Let us know that she's okay. Show us her face.
More than 100 Israelis are being held hostage inside Gaza. The U.S. says it's working to help free them. Also today, there's increased focus on Egypt and the border it shares with Gaza.
There are only two ways in and out of Gaza. One is controlled by Israel, and the other one is controlled by Egypt.
I'm Carol Hills. Meanwhile, in tech news, Spotify is using AI to make the voices of English-speaking podcasters.
If you took the full body of work that you've produced,
speak Spanish.
Si tomaras todo el trabajo que has realizado,
intrigued? Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. We start today with what continues to be the top story in international news, the war between Hamas and Israel. So far, it has claimed at least 2,600 lives. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is on a high-stakes diplomatic mission to the region, aiming to prevent a wider regional war from breaking out. He spoke in Tel Aviv today with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu by his side.
We will reaffirm the crystal clear warning that President Biden issued yesterday to any adversary, state or non-state, thinking of taking advantage of the current crisis to attack Israel. Don't. The United States has Israel's back.
Blinken's comments come in the wake of Hezbollah firing rockets into Israel across the northern border with Lebanon. The Secretary of State also said that the U.S. has already shipped military hardware to Israel to replenish its missile defense system, the Iron Dome. Also today, the White House announced it's arranging evacuation flights for Americans in Israel and has confirmed that 27 Americans have been killed in the violence, with 14 more missing. Meanwhile, Israel is moving toward a war footing, and Prime Minister Netanyahu has reorganized his government. Netanyahu has partnered with opposition leader and former army commander Benny Gantz to form a war cabinet. In Gaza, an Israeli ground invasion looks likely. 360,000 Israeli military reservists have been called up. The country's airline will fly on Saturday during Shabbat for the first time in 41 years to bring reservists back home. Most other flights to Israel are suspended. That's as Israeli warplanes bombed Gaza again today. The Gaza Strip is a densely settled area, only 25 miles long and less than 8 miles wide. Entire neighborhoods have been destroyed there since the weekend, and most of Gaza's 2.2 million people are now without electricity. The sole power station in Gaza ran out of fuel yesterday, as Israeli officials say they are choking off basic supplies to Gaza. Many residents want to get out of Gaza before an anticipated invasion by Israel, but so far they're trapped. One issue U.S. officials are reportedly discussing with Israelis and Egyptians is the creation of a safe passage to get some people out. There's a border crossing from Gaza to Egypt, but it's been bombed in recent days by Israel. And Egypt has its own concerns about opening up that border crossing as a humanitarian corridor. The World's Shirin Jafari reports.
This was the scene on Tuesday at the Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt. Plumes of dust and smoke rise in the sky. People frantically look for cover following the Israeli airstrikes. Egypt was the first Arab country to establish relations with Israel, and the two sides have coordinated over border security. Since the weekend atrocities carried out by Hamas and the subsequent response by Israel, there's renewed attention at the Rafah border crossing and the role that Egypt can play in mediating between the two sides.
There are only two ways in and out of Gaza. One is controlled by Israel and the other one is controlled by Egypt.
Mirat Mabrouk is the director of the Egypt and Horn of Africa program at the Middle East Institute.
People cross over from Gaza, whether it's for work or to visit people. But the main case is often medical attention, because it's almost impossible to find where they are.
And right now, people in Gaza are in desperate need of medical attention. With the siege, bombardment and a potential ground invasion, things will likely get worse. That's why the Rafah border crossing is crucial. It's the only point where people can leave or for humanitarian aid to get in. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan was asked about this at a press briefing this week.
Without getting into the specifics of safe passage for civilians and so forth, I will say it's something that the U.S. government is seized with in supporting how we do that operationally.
Israel has warned Egypt that any trucks carrying aid to Gaza will be targeted, and the airstrikes on Tuesday prompted Egypt to close the Rafah border crossing. But the Egyptian foreign minister told Reuters today that the border is open again. Meanwhile, Egypt doesn't want to turn the border crossing into a humanitarian corridor.
Traditionally, Egypt has been very concerned about steps that could be seen as shifting the burden of Gaza from Israel to Egypt.
Michael Hanna is with the International Crisis Group.
In the most extreme case, this manifests itself in recurrent ideas that pop up in the Egyptian media and Egyptian press about the resettling of Gaza residents in Sinai. This has been a trope that emerges in times of crisis, and it harkens back to other points of expulsion and displacement and transfer. And that is the kind of ultimate fear of Egypt, that somehow this burden becomes Egypt's direct responsibility.
Some Gaza residents, like humanitarian worker Najla Shaba, have the same concern. They are worried that if they leave Gaza, they might not be able to return.
I don't want to leave Gaza. I will try my best not to go to Egypt. I would want to travel, but to come back. I want to travel on a break, but I want to make sure I have the right to come back to my home.
She was speaking with the BBC. Mirat Mabrouk of the Middle East Institute says Israel has proposed relocating Palestinians to Egypt in the past, and this poses real concerns.
What Egypt is rejecting, the answer to that can be found in the many refugee camps in several Arab countries that contain the descendants of Palestinians that were shoved out of Palestine in 1948 and 1956 and 1967 and have never been allowed to go back by Israel.
Egypt is also worried that the fighting could spill over into its territory. That worry might prompt it to play a mediating role between Hamas and Israel. But Michael Hanna says Egypt is still trying to figure out its next steps.
The savagery of this weekend's attack, the severity and the shock that this has posed to Israeli society has maybe put us in different territory now.
Egyptian officials don't want Hamas militants to enter Sinai and possibly pose security problems. Egypt has fought a counterinsurgency against another group, the Islamic State, in this area in the past decade. Still, officials in Sinai are gearing up to receive refugees fleeing the siege and the bombardments in Gaza. Reports say they have set aside food and medical supplies and have designated residential buildings to shelter newcomers. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
That's the scene at Israel's southern border with Egypt. Meanwhile, to the north, clashes on Israel's border with Lebanon have heightened fears that the war between Israel and Hamas could spill over into regional conflicts. Hezbollah, the militant group in Lebanon, is a longtime enemy of Israel, but Hezbollah has also had a rocky relationship with Hamas. Reporter Rebecca Collard is in Beirut talking to Lebanese citizens and is hearing both fear and defiance about the potential of an escalation with Israel.
On a street in Beirut's Ain al-Ramani neighborhood, Kamil Karbaj watches his country's southern border with concern.
Of course we're worried. Like, we're worried that Israel might come here and start bombing us.
In the last few days, there have been volleys of rockets and fire across the border between Lebanon and Israel. On Monday, several Palestinian fighters from Lebanon even managed to cross the border and engage in a firefight with Israeli soldiers. Residents have fled from some villages in South Lebanon, fearing an escalation. And 50 miles north, many like Karbaj are worried as well. Karbaj pulls up his shirt to show me the scars on his abdomen, back and arms. This neighborhood was a front line between Christian and Shia Muslim militias during Lebanon's civil war.
I was shot in the civil war. I lived here in the civil war. I got shot in the arm and the stomach. I was a little kid. I didn't have anything to do with anything.
Some of the buildings here are also scarred by fighting, pockmarked with bullet holes. And for many, this is a daily reminder of the price of war. But there is also defiance against Israel. A few streets away in the Shaya area, posters of Hezbollah martyrs who died fighting for the group in previous conflicts, and the flags of both Hezbollah and Amal, another Shia group, hang next to shops and cafes. Over the sound of a water truck, Abid Sarhan tells me he's not worried, and if Hezbollah goes to war, he's ready to join. Quickly after Hamas's unprecedented attack on southern Israel last week, Israeli, American, and other Western officials pointed the finger at Tehran, asserting that Iran helped coordinate and plan the attack. Pundits followed with speculation that Iran could tell Hezbollah to open a second front on Israel's northern border. That's not true, says Sarhan. We take money, we take support, we take weapons from Iran, but the decision to go to war is our decision. Western officials have since walked back those accusations about Iran's role in the attack, and the U.S. has said it has no intelligence directly linking Iran. Hezbollah has its own grievances with Israel. Israel still occupies the disputed Sheba Farms, a small strip of territory on the border of Lebanon, Israel, and Syria. Hezbollah was born from Israel's almost two-decade-long occupation of South Lebanon. Hezbollah was credited with pushing them out in 2000. In a small street cafe, Mohammed Ali Sabah says he fought for Hezbollah then. They wanted to make Lebanon part of Israel, he says. In May of 2000, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah gave a victory speech in the South Lebanese town of Bin Jabal. Indeed, Israel has nuclear weapons and the strongest air force in the region, Nasrallah told the crowd. But by God, it's weaker than a spider's web. After Hamas's surprise attack, some have referenced that speech. Hezbollah is the strongest military force in Lebanon. The National Army is much weaker despite training, weapons, and support from the U.S. and other foreign states. If a war starts here in Lebanon, it's going to be a huge war all across the world, says Sabah. Hezbollah is also a political player here, and amid the country's financial crisis, a war would be costly and unpopular. Back in Ain al-Ramani, Kamil Karbaj and his friend Mustafa Shokher stand outside a shop. We're against war, says Shokher, but if they keep doing massacres on the Palestinian people, then everyone should go to war against them. Karbaj is a Christian and Shokher is a Shia Muslim. They've been friends for 20 years and say it's their leaders that are making the political, economic, and sectarian problems in the country. We're not afraid. Half the people left Lebanon and the other half is in a dire situation, he says. Regular Lebanese will have very little say about what happens next on their border. That will be up to Israel and Hezbollah, and whether they choose restraint or escalation. For The World, I'm Rebecca Collard in Beirut.
Senator Bob Menendez is facing new allegations today. Federal prosecutors are charging that he acted as an unregistered agent of the Egyptian government. Those charges were added to an existing indictment that accused Menendez of accepting bribes and secretly helping Egyptian officials. At the time of the alleged criminal activities, he served as chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Authorities who searched Menendez's home last year said they found more than $100,000 in gold bars and over $480,000 $1,000 in cash, much of it hidden in closets, clothing, and a safe. Menendez has insisted that he did nothing unusual to assist Egypt and that prosecutors had misunderstood the work of a senator involved in foreign affairs. Coming up next, Argentina's sky-high inflation is fueling radical economic proposals ahead of the presidential election there later this month. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Here in the U.S., we've been feeling the effects of inflation, but it's not even close to what Argentina has been facing. This year, consumer prices there rose 124%, meaning people are paying more than twice what they used to. Not surprisingly, the economy is top of mind for voters in Argentina's presidential election this month. As The World's Tibi Saizea reports, one controversial economic policy is gaining a lot of traction.
Argentinians are used to dealing with inflation, but not like this. Nicolas Nurkic owns a small plastic packaging business in Buenos Aires, the capital.
Muy difícil tener un negocio en Argentina.
He says this year has been particularly difficult for his business because prices change every week. He's now changing the inventory at his shop to figure out how to make a profit these days. Also in Buenos Aires, Flor Giovinazza is a marketing professional working for a consulting firm.
Even though I am a good performer, I have salary adjustments every other month, but still my salary is very, very affected.
She says she started working for the company 15 years ago in an entry-level position. At that time, her salary was the equivalent of $1,800 a month. Now she's a manager, but with the dramatic devaluation of the peso, her pay is only worth about $800.
It's very difficult for young people to be able to live on their own. Most of my friends have already moved abroad.
As Argentinians head to the polls to elect a new president, the leading candidate in the race is Javier Milei. He's a radical libertarian whose main promise is to abolish the central bank and adopt the U.S. dollar.
El peso es la moneda que emite el político argentino.
The peso is the currency issued by Argentine politicians, and therefore is worth less than excrement, he said on a popular radio show this week. Martin Castellano, an Argentinian economist with the Institute of International Finance, explains why Milei's proposal to dollarize the economy is highly popular.
I think because of the overwhelming demand for macroeconomic stability, for price stability after more than a decade of double-digit inflation, and also very low policy credibility.
For decades, Argentina has suffered from disastrous economic policies. The country defaulted on its national debt in 2020, and it's cut off from international borrowing. The government has been printing money, which has made inflation worse, says Castellano.
Basically, the state living beyond its means in terms of spending.
Replacing the peso with the U.S. dollar would be an instant fix, as Castellano points out.
Very straightforward. I mean, it helps reduce inflation very fast. It's a quick fix for that.
But the quick fix would have bad consequences in the long term, he says. By switching to dollars, Argentina would adopt the monetary policy of the United States. And that would really tie the government's hands, Castellano says.
Economy becomes very inflexible and rigid to withstand these shocks.
Other countries in the region, including Ecuador and El Salvador, have dollarized their economies. But in these countries, there tends to be high unemployment and low growth rates. Bruno Binetti, a fellow at the Inter-American Dialogue, points to an additional problem.
For an economy the size of Argentina, you're going to need a lot of dollars to make that work. And Argentina doesn't have them. In fact, we have a chronic scarcity of dollars.
Also, Binetti says dollarization wouldn't solve the structural problems that have caused high inflation, such as government overspending. Both experts agree that Argentina still needs to make more economic adjustments before it's ready to get rid of its currency. For The World, I'm Tibi Saizea.
For our next story, we're going to put you through a little test. Is this next clip really me speaking Spanish, or is it AI? ¿Qué opinas? ¿Esto suena como un ser humano real hablando español? ¿O crees que ha sido creado por la AI? Any guesses? It really was me speaking, but if you listen to certain podcasts on Spotify, it might not be a real human voice you're hearing. The company is now using a new tool to translate a few English language podcasts into other languages, using AI to emulate the original host's own voice. The World's Bianca Hillier has the details.
One of the podcasts taking part in Spotify's translation project is The Diary of a CEO, hosted by Steve Bartlett. Here's part of an episode released this summer.
If you took the full body of work that you've produced over the last, let's say, 10 years, and the work that you're going to produce over the next 10 years...
It's in English, as are all previous episodes. But now it's also in Spanish. Here's that same clip translated by AI.
Si tomaras todo el trabajo que has realizado en los últimos, digamos, 10 años y el trabajo que vas a realizar en los próximos 10 años...
To be clear, that is Bartlett's real voice, but he doesn't speak Spanish. It's all the work of AI.
It's uncanny that they can reproduce the cadence of the speaker with pretty serviceable translations.
Flora Thompson-DeVoe translates Spanish and Portuguese podcasts into English text in Rio de Janeiro. Spotify's translations sounded slightly robotic to her, but she says they're workable. Simon Spungen is another translator, but he doesn't speak Spanish. He's impressed by the Spanish version of the podcasts.
It sounded absolutely natural. Which is, you know, why I take my hat off to the technology. I think it's incredible.
Spotify calls the technology groundbreaking. In a press release, the company says they used OpenAI's newly released voice generation technology to turn English into Spanish. French and German translated episodes are on their way, too. It's all in an effort to, quote, bridge the language gap so that these voices can be heard worldwide, according to the press release. But Thompson-DeVoe wonders what will be lost.
There's bound to be a flattening of the way that people express themselves.
For example, native speakers often use phrases or sayings that don't directly translate into another language.
And I think that AI is just not built to deal with that sort of creativity. Either it'll be gibberish, or it'll try to shoehorn it into something that's intelligible. It can only work with what's in its repertoire, right? From what I understand.
Spungen, who translates from Hebrew to English and is based in the U.S., also sees possible issues with the tool. He used to host a podcast for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz and says he would not have wanted it translated into a language he didn't actually speak, because then...
I have no way of verifying that the subtleties and the nuances of what I'm saying are correctly rendered in a foreign language.
Spotify declined an interview request for this story, but in an email, a company spokesperson said they worked with creators and linguists to ensure a real human reviewed all of the translations. Whether or not native speakers will flock to AI-translated episodes remains to be seen. But Thompson-DeVoe says, in general, she doesn't think the translated podcasts pose a threat to productions by native speakers because they're bringing completely different cultural lenses.
Joe Rogan in Spanish is not Radio Ambulante. Joe Rogan in Portuguese is not Rádio Novela Presente. So in that sense, they're completely incomparable.
And in part for that reason, Thompson-DeVoe and Spungen aren't concerned about losing their day jobs. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
You're listening to The World. It is not easy being an opposition figure in Venezuela, but Maria Corina Machado is confident in her chances and that her presidential win would help stop a nationwide exodus.
The only way we can stop people leaving from Venezuela desperately is that we have the hope that we will have political change.
My interview with Machado, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was in Israel today, showing support for a close U.S. ally. Blinken also urged the Israelis to show restraint in their military response against Hamas to protect the lives of Palestinian civilians. He also said the United States is working to help free the hostages taken by Hamas. As the Israeli military prepares for what appears to be a major assault on Gaza, the fate of those hostages is on the minds of many. The World's Matthew Bell reports.
One of the deadliest scenes from the Hamas attack over the weekend took place at a big outdoor dance party in southern Israel. More than 250 people were killed and an unknown number were taken hostage by Hamas. Antony Blinken met with some survivors of that attack today, and he told one of them, Lior Gelbaum, that he's working to free the hostages.
We're thinking of them and trying to do everything we can.
I know.
We want to bring them home.
Thank you so much for being here.
I'm so sorry to go through this.
It means a lot.
In many ways, Israel and Hamas have been here before. The two sides have fought four wars since 2006, the most recent in 2021. But as Israel continues to conduct airstrikes inside the Gaza Strip, and hundreds of thousands of Israeli troops gather along Gaza's borders, they're facing something different this time, and that's the presence of more than 100 Israeli civilians being held captive in Gaza. Speaking with Bloomberg News, Israel's Minister of Strategic Affairs, Ron Dermer, said Hamas made a critical miscalculation with this recent attack.
It may take some time, but we're going to exact such a high price that not only will Hamas never consider doing this again, I think none of Israel's enemies are going to ever think about doing something like this again.
The assumption is that Hamas took hostages as bargaining chips, with the intention of exchanging them for thousands of Palestinians held in Israeli jails. Among the hostages now in Gaza are women, children, and elderly people. Hamas has said it will start executing them one by one if Israel bombs Palestinian homes without warning. I asked Moran Zaga what she makes of that threat by the leaders of Hamas.
They're a vicious, violent organization, and I take it very seriously.
Zaga is an expert on the Gulf Arab region. She's with an Israeli think tank called Mitvim. Zaga says there's a diplomatic effort getting underway to free Israeli hostages, and it's being led by Qatar, a country that has no official relationship with Israel.
Only Qatar has its direct and very close connection with Hamas. That's why it has its leverage more than Egypt and other countries who are trying to mediate themselves.
Qatar helps fund Hamas in Gaza. It also hosts the leaders of Hamas's political wing. Zaga says it's not clear how much leverage they have over the Hamas military commanders inside the Gaza Strip.
And the question is whether they listen now to their political leadership that is based in Qatar. That's the key issue here. And if so, then I'm very hopeful that Qatar can achieve some sort of settlement through its influence on the political leadership.
Qatar's emir was on an official visit to Germany, where the government is calling on the Qataris to help free the hostages held by Hamas. Gilad Shir is an Israeli lawyer and former negotiator in the peace process with the Palestinians. He says Hamas is violating international law by not disclosing the identity, location, or health condition of the hostages.
There's also a real fear that Hamas will trade the Israeli abductees with other Palestinian terrorist organizations. It has already announced that 30 of them have been handed to the Islamic Jihad.
Moran Zaga says public debate in Israel about the hostage situation has been relatively muted.
I think that the reason that we do not discuss this in Israel to a greater extent is not to limit the military operation.
Zaga says it's been disappointing from Israel's perspective to hear almost no public support from some of its Arab neighbors. Bahrain and the United Arab Emirates normalized relations with Israel 3 years ago. And more recently, the Saudi government has been talking with the Biden administration about following suit. But none of those governments has publicly condemned Hamas for this recent attack. For The World, I'm Matthew Bell.
The families and friends of those abducted in the Hamas attacks find themselves in a terrifying limbo. They're piecing together information about their loved ones' abductions, but they can't begin to imagine what will happen next to these hostages. Naom Alon's girlfriend is among the hostages. 27-year-old Inbar Hayman was captured Saturday at a music festival near Gaza. Hamas militants killed hundreds of concertgoers there. Alon learned what happened to Hayman from other survivors of the attack and from propaganda videos that Hamas filmed and circulated afterwards.
In this video, you can see Inbar for 38 seconds for a terrorist hold her. This video is not easy to watch. I didn't watch it myself, and also not her parents, and we don't want it to be published.
I understand that when the Hamas militants showed up initially, that Inbar scrambled to get into a car with her friends. What happened then?
Because there were a lot of cars and only one road to go out, so there was the cars really, they couldn't go forward. At that point, police officer, when they heard the shooting, they told everybody to leave the cars and to run to the area of the stage. There they were hiding under the stage for a few hours. In some point, Inbar split the former friends and she joined these two guys. They ran together.
What happened then?
There were terrorists who was really close to them, two terrorists. One of them had a knife. From what we know from these two guys' testimonial, one of them had a knife, so Inbar at some point stopped running because she was afraid he would stab her. At this point, the terrorist managed to hold Inbar, and one of the guys stopped running, and he grabbed a wood stick that was on the ground, and he ran to the terrorist straight to fight with him. She was free for a few moments, and the guy with the stick shouted for her, like, go away, run away. And at this moment, Inbar was in shock, and another two terrorists came with a motorbike, and they reached to her and grabbed her and took her up on the motorbike.
So she just kind of froze, and that's when the two militants came and kind of swept her up and put her on the motorbike, and they drove off?
Exactly. When that happened, when they took her, all the terrorists get what they wanted, we can say, and terrorists go to the other direction, back to Gaza. From this video, it's possible I didn't watch it by myself, but from what we know, she got hurt in her face. Perhaps she tried to resist. Perhaps they prefer to take her when she is, like, not in conscious, so it will be easier for them.
Yeah. You've alluded to this video, and I know you haven't watched it. Is it just too difficult for you to watch it?
Yes. I got recommendation from family, from friends. They told me it's better for me not to watch it. And, of course, these days are the hardest for us. They can use people for leverage. We just want to have a life signal from her, from Hamas, from anybody who can give us this sign. Let us know that she's okay. Show us her face. Show us that she's getting medical help if she needed.
Noam, are you or Inbar's family in touch with other Israeli families whose relatives have been taken hostage?
We do. The last days, all the hostages' families are united in these days to show us one message that we want our loved back. We want our citizens and soldiers and daughters and friends and all the ones who taken, we want them back alive and safe.
This is a difficult question, but I'm going to ask it. You're, of course, hoping for a sign of life from her captors or anyone who can give you information about Inbar and her condition. At the same time, the Israeli military is preparing for a possible ground operation in Gaza, which could, of course, be dangerous for the hostages. How do you feel about that?
I'm not in a position to tell the army to do this way or another way. I can only ask as a boyfriend and say for the families and in the voice of all the people that her loves has been kidnapped. We understand the necessity of the army to act, but we just hope that when they are acting, not to forget all the girls and boys that were taken. I'm not a politician. I'm not a commander. I'm just a young guy who lost his girlfriend. And I really will do everything to hear good news, to see her back here with us.
Noam, how are you keeping yourself busy during these very difficult days of trying to find out what's happened to Inbar?
Trying to be as strong as I can. I'm surrounded by lots of family and friends. I want everybody to know her and her story, to see her photo, to know her face. She's out there. She's alive. I want no one will forget her. I want everybody to fight for Inbar, to remind our government, to Hamas, to everybody that Inbar should go back to us.
Noam Alon has been speaking with us from Binyamina, Israel. His girlfriend, 27-year-old Inbar Hyman, was kidnapped from a music festival last Saturday near Gaza, where Hamas militants killed hundreds of people. Thank you so much for speaking to us, Noam.
Thank you for your time. Goodbye.
New Zealand's young and progressive former Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern was once one of the country's most popular leaders. When she stepped down last January, it took many by surprise. The first general election since then is this Saturday. And as the World's Sarah Birnbaum reports, New Zealanders find themselves in a changed political landscape.
On election night 2020, Jacinda Ardern and her centre-left Labour Party won in a landslide. She began her victory speech in Māori. New Zealand stood out for its progressive policies at a time when right-wing populism was sweeping across the globe. Fast forward 3 years, and a coalition of right-wing parties is expected to win the elections, and they're stirring up anti-Māori sentiment to get votes. Anti-Māori racism is nothing new, says Richard Shaw. He teaches politics at Massey University of New Zealand.
Some of it is really explicit, some of it is tacit, some of it is dog whistling, and all of it speaks to the fault lines that characterize most former colonies, and certainly this one.
He says race is emerging as an issue now, though, because Māori have been so successful at getting political representation, winning reparations, getting the Māori language taught in schools, and more.
There is an increasing confidence amongst Māori to speak their language and to be Māori. And for many of us, that makes this place a better place to live in. But there are a significant number of New Zealanders for whom that is threatening.
Last month, a group of Māori leaders wrote an open letter to politicians condemning what they called unacceptable levels of racism in the campaign. Margaret Mutu is one of the leaders who signed the letter. She's a professor of Māori studies at the University of Auckland.
The right-wing politicians are enabling and emboldening white supremacists to issue some quite horrible and vicious threats to both Māori politicians and to Māori in general.
A Māori lawmaker, Willow Jean Prime, says she was at a debate recently where the audience shouted her down every time she used a Māori word.
When I said puku for full tummies, lunches and schools, I was shouted at. When I said Aotearoa, the crowd responded, it's New Zealand. When I said rangatahi, stop speaking that language.
The centre-right National Party is leading in the polls, but it won't get enough support to govern alone. That means National will need to form a coalition with one and maybe two hard-right parties. One party, ACT, wants a referendum that would restrict Māori rights, rights that have been upheld through the courts since the mid-1980s. The other party, New Zealand First, wants English to be the only official language of New Zealand. It wants to strip government departments of their Māori names and scrap bilingual road signs. Take our country back is the party slogan. Last month, New Zealand First candidate Robert Ballantyne said this about Māori.
Cry if you want to, we don't care. You've pushed it too far. And we're the party with the cultural mandate and the courage to cut out your disease and bury you permanently.
During a TV debate, Labour leader Christopher Hipkins, who replaced Ardern when she stepped down and is now running to keep his job, repeated those words to the frontrunner, National Party leader Christopher Luxon.
Christopher, you're willing to work with these people. Why?
Well, I don't want to work with New Zealand First, but I am going to make the call if it means that I stop you to Party Murray and the Greens coming to power in 3 years.
Do you think that's racist?
I do. I don't think that's acceptable at all.
So why are you willing to
help
them sitting around the cabinet table?
Hipkins has continued this line of attack in recent speeches.
We've seen leaders who see anti-Māori positions as vote winners. They reach out to New Zealanders through one-liners like one system for all, putting the narrative that Māori somehow are getting things that other New Zealanders aren't.
But the right-wing message is clearly resonating. A poll out yesterday shows ACT and New Zealand First together getting around 15% of the vote. Political analyst Richard Shaw says his concern is that if the right-wing parties gain ground, the government will become increasingly stacked with hardliners who are nostalgic for the days when Māori didn't have a say in public life and Māori culture wasn't quite so visible.
If those guys, and they are just about all guys, if those guys are in power the next time round, then the executive branch, certainly the parliamentary branch, but the executive branch will contain political actors who want to weaponize race in ways which perhaps we haven't seen for some time.
That's the long-term risk, he says, that racist rhetoric will become the norm in New Zealand. For the world, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The Paris Olympics are less than a year away. Between now and then, athletes will be competing for prized slots on their national teams. That will not be an option for athletes from Russia, though. In 2019, the International Olympic Committee barred Russia's official national team from competing under its own flag. That was punishment for a state-sponsored doping program. But Russian athletes were still allowed to compete under the banner Russian Olympic Committee, a compromise that was fiercely criticized after Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine. But now the governing body of the Olympics appears to have had enough. Last week, the Russian Olympic Committee announced it would draw athletes from Ukrainian territories under Russian occupation. That was a step too far for the IOC. This morning, it suspended the Russian Olympic Committee for violating Ukraine's territorial integrity. There is, though, still a possibility that individual Russian athletes could participate in Paris as neutral competitors. Venezuela was once among the richest countries in Latin America. It was a major exporter of oil. But in recent years, economic hardship, hunger, and political turmoil have triggered a mass exodus from the country. In the past decade, one in five Venezuelans has left. This follows nearly 25 years of authoritarian rule, first by Hugo Chavez, then by his hand-picked successor, Nicolas Maduro. Maria Corina Machado is one of the most outspoken critics of Maduro and the leading opposition figure hoping to challenge him in next year's election. She joins us from the Venezuelan capital, Caracas. Maria Corina Machado, for the Venezuelans who have not left their home country, what are living conditions like?
Well, what we are living right now is a tragic situation in every sense. In Venezuela, we have a whole generation of children that are growing without nutrition, without education, and without their mothers, that have had to leave the country in order to send something back home for their children to survive.
You hope to challenge Nicolas Maduro in the 2024 election, but you have to first win the primary. The Venezuelan government has disqualified you from running. How do you plan to win anyway?
Well, I will win the primary just in 10 days, and that will give us strong support and legitimacy to unite all the country in pressing the regime to accept what the will of the Venezuelan people will be on the primary election. And I'm sure that with that legitimacy, I will have also the support of the international community, not only the governments that are democratic and allies of our cause, but also even those governments, such as the Colombian government, that are closer to Maduro, but that will understand that it is in their own benefit to facilitate and support a democratic transition. So I will run against Maduro and I will win the presidential election.
You have proposed privatizing the state-owned oil company Petróleos de Venezuela, PDVSA. That's a taboo in local politics. Why do you think that's essential?
Because Venezuela, under our government, will turn into the energy hub of the Americas. But no private company will invest in a country where there's no rule of law, where there's no services such as electricity or roads, and where there's no human capital that is qualified to work in these huge new developments, not only oil and gas, but also in clean energies. And that will be one of the main decisions that we will take as soon as we arrive to the presidency of Venezuela. And I believe that will be in the benefit of our people, because we will create jobs and we will bring new enterprises, private enterprises, in every potential sector of our economy.
How has that proposal to privatize the state-owned oil company been received by Venezuelans?
Well, I would just say that regarding the primary support, 88% of those that say that are willing to participate with a strong probability are supporting me, 88%. So that's a signal of how people want change.
If you win the primary and become the opposition candidate, you'll face significant challenges. The previous opposition leader, Juan Guaido, has an arrest warrant out for him, and he's been living in exile. What's your plan for staying in this race despite the weight of the government against you?
Well, all of us, and we are literally talking of hundreds of thousands of Venezuelans that have raised our voices against the regime, have faced, you know, all sort of damage. And we have hundreds of political prisoners right now. And we realize that the danger is certain, is real, is present, is huge, is growing. But at the same time, having the support of the international community and media, you know, raising our voices, it increases the cost for the regime to harm us even more.
Juan Guaido was the last opposition leader who had widespread support in Venezuela. He won a seat in parliament during the last election, but years of protests by his supporters and emphatic endorsements from foreign leaders did not help Guaido, and he was stopped from taking office. Why do you think it will go differently for you?
I think the situation is totally different. The regime has lost all its social support. The Chavistas are joining our movement. Even in the armed forces and the police corps, people are coming close to us because they also demand change. Their families are living under terrible conditions. And also the Venezuelan movement that has arisen in the last months is much stronger. This is not seen as a political struggle, but as an existential one, even a spiritual one. So I think Venezuela is prepared and determined to have political change, and the world should be prepared to see Maduro being defeated.
The U.S. has suggested it could ease sanctions on Venezuela if the government of President Nicolas Maduro made democratic advances, for instance, by improving its electoral system. Where do things stand in terms of democratization in Venezuela at this point?
Look, sanctions that are in place right now could be, as you say, sometimes some lifted, some weakened in exchange for real commitments from the regime that we will move forward into a democratic transition through free and fair elections.
How much support are you feeling from the U.S. in general, especially from the Venezuelan diaspora?
Huge support. Huge support. Almost 8 million Venezuelans live around the world, and I have communication with many of them.
Are the most number of Venezuelans who live outside of Venezuela in the United States?
Yes. The most part of Venezuelans live in the United States and in Colombia. And the third country would be Spain.
So many of those Venezuelans who have left Venezuela will have a chance to vote in the primary on October 22nd?
Absolutely. They've registered, and we were able to organize this around the world, as I say. And I think this will be a huge precedent for getting the right for all Venezuelans that are abroad to be able to vote in the presidential elections of 2024. They are our voices around the world. I'm very proud of them, but I certainly want them back.
Maria Corina Machado is a Venezuelan politician leading the opposition to President Nicolas Maduro. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us on this Thursday. Be with us again tomorrow for ongoing coverage of the war between Israel and Hamas and all the day's global news. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here tomorrow.